Rutgers' point was that if we all were involved in that to a greater extent than we are now, through the way our policies are set up, through insurance provided through our employer, we would help all of us together in making those decisions to bring down the cost, or at least in one way of bringing down the cost. I thought he made a very interesting point, and one of the things that struck me when I was reading about what they're doing with Safeway is that there are people out there trying to come up with answers that are not necessarily driving us in the direction of having the government provide all those answers or provide the care for us. There's not all the answers out of that, but it just seems to me that that probably will give us a better response to the particular challenges we have right now. Okay, I'm going to go out once again, this time to, I think this is Rancho Cordova. Hello?
Hi, this is Louise Benson from Rancho.
Yes,
I just have a question about people that are disabled and aren't going to be able to work, that have just lost their eye and their teeth care, their dental care. What is the plan for us?
Are you talking about some of the decisions that have been made at the state level?
Yes.
I don't know what that answer is, because there are certain programs that are decided upon by the state in terms of the state having the responsibility for providing that. The state, as we all know, is going through a terrible circumstance right now where it can't pay its bills. And so they're making some very difficult decisions. And the only answer I can give to you is that you need to at least bring that question up to your assemblyman and your state senator to find out what they're doing and what the implications are. What I would like to say is this. This is a prime example of what happens when the government at this level, the state government, promises more than it can perform. When it does that and goes into a lot of other areas where it doesn't have the greatest priority to be there, they end up not being able to do some of the things that we would believe to be essential to them. And my concern is not only what's happening to our home state of California and the difficulty that the governor and the legislature is having in working it out, but my great concern is that what happened in California can happen to us in the nation. As I said before, last week or a week and a half ago, we reached an extraordinary point. We actually found that we have a debt this year, a deficit this year of $1 trillion. That means we're spending more than we're taking in to the tune of over $1 trillion. Some believe it'll end up this year being $1.6 or $1.8 trillion. We've never had anything like that in the history of this country. If we don't get that under control, we'll have tough decisions to make with respect to Medicare and Medi-Cal, as it's called in California, or Medicaid, and there will be some draconian decisions that will have to be made at that time. So the sooner we're actually honest about the situation we're in, the better off we're going to be. And for us now to say, well, the answer to our health care problems is to have a government-run health plan, and I'm saying that because I believe if you have the plan that's being looked at in Congress right now with a public option, it will ultimately end up in a government-only program. And that's at least $1 trillion. And once we hit that brick wall, where we're spending far more than we're taking in, at some point in time, we're going to have to say, wait a second, we've got to cut back. And the only way you cut back on a government-run health plan is by rationing. And I frankly don't want somebody in Washington, D.C. or somewhere else in the government telling me, for instance, no, you can't have a hip replacement, or you'll have to wait 4 years for it. Or we've decided that you can't have a pacemaker because you're a certain age, and we only reserve that to younger people. That is not the kind of system that I think, frankly, the Americans will stand for, and I hope we're not driving in that direction. All right, let me try and go out here to Elk Grove. Hello.
Hello, yes. My name is Bonnie.
Yes, Bonnie.
I'm thinking in terms of a different, some different issues. I think that one of the reasons that healthcare is so expensive in this country is because it is run by the pharmaceutical companies, the FDA, and the American Medical Association. That's indeed unfortunate because there are many other alternative forms of treatment that will, and in many cases, do work. But those three organizations run things in this country. You know, I'm in a situation where I have a major illness and I'm having to go to Mexico next week to get treatment to help me. No insurance company is going to pay for that, even though it is cheaper than what is being offered by the American Medical Association. So I think it is time for legislators and individuals such as yourself to look at who runs medicine in this country. And as long as those three organizations are running the medical community in this country, you're not going to be able to do anything to bring the cost down. It is big business. There is a lot of money made by pharmaceutical companies. There are a lot of there's a lot of money being made by hospitals and what have you, and a lot of those costs could be defrayed if people in a free country could make free choices. Let me give you one quick example. I wanted to get something called B17, which is a vitamin B17. It is illegal in this country to get it. Why is that? Why would a vitamin be illegal? The reason that it's illegal is because pharmaceutical companies cannot make any money from it. And I'm just giving you one example, but there are thousands. There are many. And so until people are free to choose the type of health care that they want, choose the type of treatment that they want, choose whether or not they want drugs or a holistic approach to their illness, American people have the right to decide what they want to do. But because of the pharmaceutical companies, the FDA, and the American Medical Association, that's not happening in this country. So I would urge you and other legislators to look and see what can be done about that.
Well, thank you very much for your comments, Bonnie. I would just say that we do allow, I think there's a greater acceptance in society today for quote-unquote holistic medicine. There are things that are viewed today that were viewed with some skepticism just a number of years ago. Having said that, however, I would say you really need to look at why we created an FDA and why we created a structure of the federal government that that requires drugs to go through a rigorous scientific review before they're allowed on the market. And then we put them in different categories. In some cases, we have them on a schedule, meaning that they can only be provided by a doctor providing us a prescription. And it really goes back to what happened in the 1800s when you had a lot of medicine men running around, and I don't mean Native Americans. I'm talking about these traveling shows where someone would actually have a particular elixir that was supposed to be good, and much of it was fraudulent. Subsequent to that, we decided that it was important to have at least a review of these sorts of things to protect the public from fraudulent claims, and also to make sure of the purity of the product that was being produced. And in large measure, that has been successful. Now, I will grant you, there are mistakes and there are delays, and we have tried to accelerate the process by which the FDA looks at and approves these various drugs that come on the market. At the same time, I'll tell you this, I believe that we are healthier today, generally speaking, in this country, and that we've extended the life expectancy in major part because we've been able to find appropriate medications. I've benefited from that, as have members of my family. I don't find a great cabal between the AMA and the pharmaceuticals and the FDA. As a matter of fact, often understand your concerns. I understand your beliefs. I've just not had that same experience that you have had. Okay, we're going to go to Folsom. I think we're at Folsom now. Hello?
Hello.
Yes, sir.
Oh, good. I have a couple of questions. I understand.
Go right ahead, sure.
And there's a giant problem with the cost. One of my questions is, if everybody is against it, are they telling their congressmen? Because, you know, we only know what we hear on TV and on the news. We don't know what's true and what isn't true. And can we afford it, and will it bankrupt the country? Secondly, what is broken in health care? I hear so many people that they do not have any coverage. Why don't they have coverage? And isn't there coverage for people that are unemployed, on welfare, for children, for infants? Seems like I grew up my whole life that there was coverage for everybody. And thirdly, whenever I moved or changed jobs, I never expected my health care to follow me. I always got health care with my new employer. Sometimes I had to wait 3 months, sometimes I never, but it worked okay. That's all I can think of.
Well, you know, you make some very strong points. Number one, I think the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office Director, Mr. Elmendorf, made it rather clear in his testimony, although he has to be nonpartisan and has to be careful about how he phrases it, but when pressed on it, basically said that this is unsustainable. The vast proposal that's before the Congress is unsustainable in terms of the cost. It will settle us with an additional $1 trillion. So that would hopefully set off alarm bells among people in Congress and around the nation on this. But the point you ask, you know, what is the problem? I think people are concerned about the cost. Costs in medical care have risen faster than the inflation rate for many, many years. The question is that increase over the inflation rate a reflection of improved care and with outcomes that are better than they would have been? In other words, if it extends, if the general medical care in this country has improved such that the lifespan of the average American is a year longer, is it worth it to have paid additional money over and above what the inflation rate is? I mean, in some cases, I think you might say yes. So the question is, what is the efficiency of the additional cost? At the same time, I'm concerned that certain lack of competition and lack of transparency allows costs to go up higher than they otherwise would be. And then the other point you make about the uninsured, the best statistics I could find are that the uninsured, and this is from the Census Bureau current population survey, that the uninsured, the total uninsured number in the United States is about 45.7 million. You then look at something that we got from the Congressional Research Service that suggests that non-citizens would be at least 9.5 million of that. Then you go and you look at those who are uninsured but are eligible for already existing public programs. That's about 12 million. And then you look at the number of people who presumably would be able to afford insurance, that is, they have income at least of $84,000 a year, and but choose not to, that's about 7.3 million. And so you then find that there's also a group, and this is according to a survey that was done, actually two surveys, 1999 and 2002, of what are known as the temporarily uninsured. That is, those who for a short period of time, I believe it is 3 months or less in any particular year, are uninsured, but then later were insured before and then return to an insured status. If you look at those number of uninsured, or those groups of uninsured, you would then find that American citizens who are lower income and long-term uninsured is about 7.8 million. Now, let's say we're off by about 10% or something, so that's up to 9 or 10 million. That is a number that has to be dealt with, but do we turn the present system upside down in order that's serving 300 million people to take care of the 7.8 to 10 million? I would argue that we ought to concentrate on the difficulties that exist with respect to those various groups I've mentioned to you, and well, more importantly, this one group that is really left, and concentrate on that rather than turn our current system upside down. That goes to the question of access to coverage. With the question of cost, I would pose those questions again. Are the additional costs that we have seen across the system inefficient, or are they reflective of improvements in health care which have had a real effect on you and me and everybody else? And number two, is it the result of a lack of competition and a lack of transparency, meaning that you don't have the information at your command as a patient, as a employer, as an employee, with respect to the costs involved? And how do we bring that to the attention of the person receiving the treatment or the employer so that they can make some rational judgments there? I'm not trying to say ration care in the sense of a government fiat, but if all of us had a better sense of what the costs involved are, we might question whether they need to have this test done of us or not, or whether we need to go to that hospital as opposed to the other hospital. And those kinds of individual decisions multiplied by millions of people would have an effect on bringing some of these costs down, better than having the government do it by way of a some sort of mandate, and that's what I'm concerned about. All right, in Carmichael, I believe. Hello.
Hi, I'm Joan.
Yes, Joan.
I just wanted to take a minute to thank you so much for having this kind of a program. It's just so amazing just to feel like, you know, you're the gentleman next door and we can voice our opinions about things that you can help us with. And I just really appreciate that.
Well, thank you. I mean, I don't have all the answers, and I'm trying to find out what people have to say about it, because ultimately when we make a decision here in Washington, D.C., it affects my neighbors back home. And if we don't have this information now, when the president's telling us in breathless terms, we've got to pass this within the next 2 weeks before we have our August break, my first question is why, and how does it impact people in my district? And the only way I can find out is having town halls like this and having regular town halls.
Well, I'm so glad you do, because let me tell you how I feel it's going to affect me.
Yes.
First of all, I'm a federal employee of 35 years. I've been voting for 40. I voted for all kinds of people. Bonnie, the one that talked about going down to Mexico, let me just say that my health care provider is now looking at options of alternate care. They don't always cover everything, but instead of the doctor always offering you a pill, they're offering you other avenues, which I appreciate very much, because I think the more natural, the more healthier, that it's better to take that than a pill. But I do have to agree with her in some respects that doctors tend to just say, here, take a pill, rather than look at what causes the problem. But aside from that, as far as health care is concerned, I'm very concerned because I will be 65 next year, will qualify for Medicare. Plan to retire in 17 months. What happens with my health care right now is, once I qualify for Medicare, that becomes my primary, and then my provider becomes my secondary. And the gentleman that talked about the only way we can find out about health care, these various things, is from our TV and our news. Well, that's not quite true, because you can do research on the Internet and find out a heck of a lot of stuff, and that's what I've done. I've been accused of being an over-analytical person, but when something's going to affect me, I want to know. So I want to give you some information, sir, and ask you if that's out there now. The only thing I'm not sure of is if it's the one in the House or the one in the Senate. But on page 16 and 17 of the bill, there's a section in there that talks about tax changes and qualified plans, and that you have to prove you have a qualified plan, and if you can't, the IRS is going to be able to fine you $5,000. That's on page 167 and 168 of this plan. That, what concerns me about that is there's a section in there about the qualified plan that says, for example, my plan, every year they raise the rate or change the rate or say, okay, you're not going to have this thing right now, you're going to have something else. According to this bill, if you have any changes in your plan, you won't be able to get private health insurance. You're going to automatically have to go into the federal government plan. That's the part that scares the bejeebers out of me right now, because I'm so close to that edge, and I just, that scares me. I want to be able to have freedom of choice. This country's been built on the freedom of choice, and I'd like to have freedom of choice to say, I want my private plan, I want to keep it, I don't want to go to this other plan.
Well, that's one of the big debates we're having over this bill. The president has said that any plan that he has and the bill that he has supported will only provide a public option.
There's a little caveat in there, and that's where I did some research on this. Mm-hmm. There's a caveat in there that says that's true to a point if your program changes. In other words, like if I lost my job and I didn't have coverage, or they quit. All right, let me give you another example. Say that, the government is going to be in competition with, let's just say a big one here in California, Kaiser.
Correct.
Okay, it's the government choice and Kaiser. Because the government doesn't have to make a profit, let's just say that Kaiser goes bankrupt. So everybody who has Kaiser can no longer have Kaiser. Guess what? We're going to have to be put in that program. There's one thing that, could happen, and that scares me. Because, I'm going to be 65, I'm a baby boomer, I've put all those years of service in, and now here I am, Social Security qualified, I got my little retirement because I planned for that. I'm going to have a little bit of Social Security, I'm going to have Medicare, and whoopee, I may not have any health insurance to cover me, and the older you are, the more you have little problems that happen to you. You're not as good as you used to be.
Well, the questions or the issues you bring up are the ones that I think are the right ones. That is, the president has said, look, we'll have the public option, but it'll just be an option. My concern is this. In order to make the public option attractive, you will have them, in some ways, subsidize their plan such that it will be more attractive than the private plan. That's the inevitable action of government in these sorts of circumstances. You will also have tremendous pressure in Congress after Congress to improve the plan by adding this benefit or that benefit or another benefit. You may say, well, that's a great deal because then we'll have a better plan. Well, the problem is, if it makes it, in a sense, more attractive than the private plans, and Kaiser and others, I believe, are not-for-profits, but they do have to make money for overhead, that sort of thing. But if you make it such that people leave the private plan to the public plan, or employers just kind of throw their hands up and say, hey, I don't need all this hassle, we'll just go with the public plan, my employees ought to do that, you inevitably come up with a government monopoly. And once you have a government monopoly and they've promised all these benefits, you see from what CBO has said, the cost will be astronomical just because of the nature of what they've promised. And at some point in time, you'll see what happens in England, what's happened in other countries, Canada and the rest of them, although Canada has it by province. The way they control costs from a government-run plan is by rationing. They make decisions, well, you're not in that category of people because of your age or your circumstance or this reason or that reason that ought to be able to get a new hip. Or you're not, and maybe I just keep saying that because I got a new hip a year ago. long, long period of time before that, and they make the decision as to when you can get it and what and if you can get it. The problem is that there's no perfect solution. There's no perfect system. But if we have transparency, information, so that you and I can make our own decisions, we can have the choice. We can make the choice. We can change our choice on a yearly basis. We can try and find the plan that is best for us, as opposed to one size fits all. And because we can choose our plans, if there are enough plans out there, the competition would be such that that would act as a guard against prices spiraling out of control, as opposed to rationing making that determination. And I just don't like the idea of a government rationing program when it deals with health care. All right, Carmichael, hello. Hello? You're on. All right. I guess they must have gotten off. All right. We'll go next to Carmichael. Hello? Hello? Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Dan, it's Michael Bryan. I met you at Optimus. You spoke for us one time. We want you back as soon as we can.
Thank you, Michael.
But as far as the health care situation, I've been in that business or was in the healthcare business as far as selling products to doctors and hospitals for about 25 years. And you know what? We do have a solution for this issue where we don't have to really go buy and change everything. There's a couple of problems we have. We don't have enough general practitioners. We can see that because we had to bring all these doctors from other countries over here to be GPs. And the other thing I can see is that we used to have county hospitals, so if indigent people needed health care, that's where they could go. Those have turned into university hospitals now that compete with the regular hospitals that they have. You have another situation where we had, back in the late 90s, some congressmen that now work for the pharmaceutical companies that passed a law that Medicare couldn't negotiate with pharmaceutical companies for drugs, whereas our VA system can. And so we have drugs that Medicare may pay, and this, I'm not giving you direct dollars, but they could be paying $40 or $50 per script, where VA pays 10 or 13. And you can really go and check this out. It's true. So I think there's about three different ways that we could solve this situation without having to go out of the country, because here's the thing. I was a national sales manager for one particular company that's here in California, and I was the Western Area Director for another large company that sold products worldwide. And what we found is that, number one, I guarantee you, when it comes to every single country that has a national program, it doesn't work. All of them, the people can afford them, have private insurance as well. And I guarantee you, there's not one of these countries that they don't ration. So you're absolutely correct on that. They do. But, I mean, the thing is, I think, to take care of our shortage of doctors, why can't we have a system like we have with the Air Force? And I wrote this in to you, is that basically is that we bring them in, we give them scholarships, and you can basically take them through residency, and then they owe the government 10 years of work after we get them through, just like a lot of the surgeons and people from the military, but have them work in these hospitals that we took and converted from county hospitals to university hospitals. And the indigent people, the 7 or 8 million, let's take care of them there. And while we're doing it, we train more physicians, more competition, and it will work out well. The other thing, as far as with the big companies, now, you know, all big companies, we all work for them, so they're not all monsters, but you get companies, and I'll give you names, like Johnson & Johnson, they bundle everybody says they have to have. And so somebody will try to sell them a trocar, and they'll say, okay, if you buy that trocar from this little company, even though it's as good as the one I make, then I'm going to have to raise your price on my suture, which is called bundling. And medicine is the only place where I've seen where that's legal and allowed. So,
I don't know about whether bundling is officially bundling is. I didn't know bundling was officially allowed. You say that is allowed under some specific exemption?
Yes. There, if you look at it, Dan, what you go in, and J&J is the, and Tyco both. Both of them will bundle because they'll say, okay, here is a contract that I have, but if you buy all my products, I'll give you this discount. And there's supposed to be a 20% window that they have, and I can show you the numbers on it, but there's supposed to be a 20% window where it won't affect the contract. But on most occasions, say a company like Applied Medical, that is one that's made here in our state, they'll go in and they can reduce the cost by 30 to 40%. The way that J&J will fight them is they'll come in and say, okay, well, I'm going to have to raise your price on stents, I'm going to have to raise your price on suture. So basically, the cost savings that you can get from buying this one product category, we're gonna wipe away by raising the cost and everything else.
Well, I'm not aware of that. I'll take a look at that. I'm on the Judiciary Committee where we deal with antitrust issues, and that sounds to me like a prima facie case of antitrust violations, unless there's some specific exemption of which I'm not aware. But anyway, I remember the event with the Optimus. Are you still meeting in the same place?
No, we moved to Lucas.
Oh, you did? Okay, well... I don't want to complain about the other place, but Lucas got great food, and I'd love to come with you sometime. Hey, thanks for all your comments on that. I'll just say a couple things very quickly. My dad was not a GP, but he was an internist, and in many cases was the primary care physician, as internists are. He was also a cardiologist. There is probably a lack of family physicians, internists, et cetera, today, and part of it has to do, I think, sometimes with the reimbursement system that basically was created by the government with Medicare, and often that leads what insurance companies do. There is often reimbursement for the kinds of things that you can actually see, giving someone a medicine, suturing up a wound, a surgical procedure, a non-invasive or invasive procedure of a diagnostic type, as opposed to the time that a good family doctor spends or a good internist spends talking with the patient and getting the entire view of the patient and perhaps finding out certain things from the patient that would lead to a solution to the patient's problem that might not be with medication or might not be with a specific surgical intervention, and that is one of the problems. We do need more primary care physicians, and we don't have as many of them coming out of medical school today as we have in the past. So thank you for your thoughts. I'm going to take a look at a couple of those things as you mentioned it, and now we're going to go out to Carmichael again. Hello.
Yes. Hello, Dr. Dan. How are you?
Fine. Thanks very much.
First of all, before I voice my opinions, I wanted to tell you that I called your Sacramento office today and had a delightful conversation with the young man who answered the phone.
Oh, good.
And yes, he was very, very polite, very nice, and we had a lot of fun. But I just would like to say I am totally and completely opposed to this idea of the government running a medical plan of any kind. Most of my friends feel the same way. I don't know how accurate my information is, but it seems to me, having been born and raised in a family that ran a business, if they have to compete with a government organization, the private companies are not going to be able to keep up cost cost-wise with them. People are going to leave their private companies and go to the government, and we are going to be left, particularly the middle class, is going to be left with no real choice.
I think you're absolutely right on this, and that's my fear, and that's why I'm not trying to be a fearmonger on this. I'm not trying to scare people away from a program that the president's presented because the president presented it. I fear the very thing that you were talking about, and we've reached a day of reckoning in California where we've discovered that you can't have the government try and do everything, and particularly you can't tax everybody beyond belief such that that will take care of the problems, and we're going to have the same thing happen on the federal level right now.
I agree.
Yeah, right now we're over $12 trillion in national debt. $12 trillion. That works out to about almost $38,000 for every man, woman, and child in America. Now we're going to put on top of that another $1 trillion.
And not only that, if you live in California, you got the California problem going also. What is that going to do?
Well, here's something that you ought to think about.
Raise taxes all the way around.
Yeah, here's something we ought to think about. They've always said, and I may have repeated this before, or said this before, but we've always said the difference between the federal government and the state government is that the federal government can print money and the state can't. But yet, what have we done in California? What California's printed out IOUs, and we saw what happened. After a couple of weeks, the banks stopped taking them.
Exactly.
Well, you could have the same thing happen on the international level. Right now, we as taxpayers through our government owe China $763.5 billion. Now, what if China decided we're not going to take any more debt of the United States? We're not going to do this. I mean, Japan is second, but China is first. They would be like the banks who are now telling California, we're not going to take those IOUs anymore. Where do we, the United States, turn if these other countries decide they're going to call our bluff? And that's the concern that I have that people are not really thinking about. We owe China $763.5 billion. We owe Japan $685.9 billion. And then we look to the oil-exporting nations, Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Kuwait. And you add all that up, we owe them almost $190 billion. Now, folks have to understand, at some point in time, if they start calling our debt in, we're in deep trouble. Or even we're in trouble if they stop buying it.
Not only that, answer me a question. If the government goes around printing money, I'm old enough to remember when our dollars were backed by gold and silver, you know, where a dollar bill said something about a silver behind it.
Mm-hmm.
You just keep printing paper money and you have nothing behind it. What does it do to the quality of our money and our debt, as big as those numbers are that you gave, are going to be double that because our money isn't going to be worth that.
Well, and here's what people don't fully think about, and particularly younger people, and they ought to be concerned about this. If you are preparing for your retirement and you are trying to figure out what kind of an income you're going to need in the future, you normally think about dollars with what they're worth at this moment. So you think, okay, I'm going to need X thousands of dollars per year to live. Well, what if those dollars are only worth half when you retire what they're worth now? You need twice as much. And that's, it seems to me that is the worst thing government can do to people who are most vulnerable, because folks in their retired years are least able to go and change their income to try and increase it in terms of what the reality that they're facing that particular year. And so what you're doing is you're telling people who actually put money away for retirement, you're being a sucker, because that money's not going to be worth it when you retire. That's why I think we have an absolute obligation on the federal level, to the extent possible, to try and retired. And
there
that's,
is no more small business in this world.
Well, actually, let me put it this way. The small business community in this country is what has, it is what creates the jobs in this country. It is what sets us apart from many other countries around the world. And the problem we have right now is that we are forgetting that in the kinds of approaches that we're taking. Many, many small businessmen and women file tax returns that are basically individual tax returns. So when the president or Nancy Pelosi says we're going to tax the millionaires, or we're going to tax anybody over $250,000 or $500,000, oftentimes that is the value of the business of a small business person who is reporting that as income on an individual tax return. And so you find a lot of people that none of us would consider to be rich who are basically creating these jobs as a result of the small businesses they're operating, put in jeopardy because it sounds fancy and it sounds fine in Washington, D.C. to say we're going to tax the rich. I'm not in those categories. My wife and I aren't in those categories. So it's not that I'm complaining that, oh my God, they're going to be taxing me or members of my family. What I'm worried about is the small business entrepreneur, the people who create the jobs in this country, are going to be really behind the eight ball. We can't afford that. And it's also not fair. Okay, Rancho Cordova, hello.
Hi, this is Jean. I really appreciate this discussion. I have a question. I really am adamantly hoping that we keep the kind of health care that we already have for those of us who have health care, or at least we'll be able to have those choices. And I heard it put forward by someone that if they took the uninsured, as you were mentioning statistics a while ago, I appreciated that. And for example, I know this is probably too simple, but too simplistic, but gave each of those people, say, $6,000 to go out and choose and buy insurance from private companies, and that become insured that way. The government could help those people that were uninsured without taking on the whole ball of wax.
You're absolutely right. That's a nice concept, and it seems to me it's not simplistic in the sense that maybe that ought to be the model that we work on. And that's one of any number of models that have been presented as an alternative to what the president is suggesting. Because what it does is, as you suggest, it maintains the overall system. And we can make some tweaks to the overall system. Look,
right.
As I said, I want to see more competition. I want to see more transparency. I want to have you and me and everybody else more involved with the decisions that are being made about our medical care, including the cost. But in terms of dealing with those who are uninsured, it may make a lot more sense for us to create a system such that those people are able to buy insurance.
And have free choice.
Absolutely. Now, I will tell you this. You do hear from some people, and I just disagree with this very strongly. They say, look, these folks aren't capable of making those decisions, or they'll make the wrong decisions, or we can't guarantee that every decision they make will be right. Well, you know something? That's part of life, and that's part of the strength of this country. We make decisions.
Some of us don't make good decisions, so...
Far be it for me to suggest that anybody in government would ever make a wrong decision.
Yeah.
and see, that's the other thing that people don't understand. If you or I make a wrong decision, it affects us. It may affect our families.
Yeah.
We'll have to work our way out. If the federal government makes a wrong decision, it affects all of us if they are in charge of the health care system. And that's what people have to reflect on. Those of us who are privileged enough to represent you and others back here in Washington, D.C., I have to have some humility. We don't have all the answers, and the people in the executive branch don't have all the answers, and frankly, there's nothing that says that there's something special about the people back here versus my neighbors at home to suggest that they'll make better decisions for us in terms of medical care for my neighbors back home. I want to keep that as close to home as possible, and I want people to have as much choice as they possibly can in these decisions.
Well, I really appreciate you holding the line, and I just hope that we can hold the line against this lunacy of putting us trillions of dollars further in debt.
Well, I'm going to keep fighting for it, I'll tell you, because it just doesn't make sense to me. You say simplistic. It's not simplistic to say you can't continue to spend vast amounts of money more than you have, and that trillions of dollars actually mean something. And this idea that, boy, it's not an expensive program because it's only going to cost us $1 trillion, to me, is just nonsense. All right, Carmichael, hello. Okay, I thought you were still on the line. All right, we'll go out to another caller from Carmichael. Hello. Hello. Well, some people have dropped off the line. Let me try again here.
Hello.
Yes, sir. I knew we'd get you. Yeah.
My name's Don Hanson.
Yes, Don.
And you know what a ileostomy is?
What? Excuse me.
An ileostomy, or the same thing as a colostomy?
Yes, sir.
You know what that is?
Yes,
well,
I do know.
My wife used to get 20 bags a month, and they cut her back to 10. So we're looking about $300 down to $150 that we have to pay now that we didn't have to pay before. My wife's 80 and I'm 83, and we're both under Medicare. Now, I understand some people are getting these power chairs, you know, for
$4,335. I've seen those ads on TV. I don't know whether how that works out, but I have seen the ads on television.
Well, I've had salesmen contact me on it, and I know personally a couple got it for $4,335.
Mm-hmm.
They really didn't need it that bad. Plus, they're worth a couple $1 million. Now, I think what Medicare ought to do, I don't begrudge the people those chairs that really need them and don't have the money. But when people have $1 million or a couple $1 million or even $100,000, they ought to have to pay for them chairs themselves. That's one reason Medicare is going broke. They give out that big money to some people and then cut its little people way down. And that's what I'm talking about.
Well, Don, let me ask you, what happened with this problem of the bags and your wife's colostomy? Was that a specific decision made with respect to her case, or was this some edict that was across the board for all of these things?
Edict across the board by Medicare.
Is that right?
It automatically cut the people getting a colostomy bag or ileostomy bag.
Well, here, what I'd love you to do, if you don't mind, is could you contact my office tomorrow, because I'd like to look into this particular issue. And my number is 916-859-9906. And I don't want to talk about the particular case over the phone with other people listening in, but I would really be interested in looking into this.
You there? Wait a minute.
Yes.
Give me your number again.
Yeah, it's 916.
916-859-9906. 9906.
And if you'd call my office in the morning and tell them that we talked, I'd like to look into this. I'd just like to have better facts on this. And as I said, I'd rather not talk over the phone with other people listening, and there are a few other people listening in, about a private matter. But this is something I would like to look into to see what the basis of the decision was and how it's affecting people such as your family. So if you do that in the morning, I'd appreciate it, and let them know that we talked tonight. All right, I'm going to go out to Citrus
just have to say that, you know, I think one way, I don't know, 16 and 7, we talk about this a lot, about the commercials for the drug industry, and he made a comment to me that, you know, maybe like the alcohol commercials and stuff and the cigarette commercials, that they don't have those anymore. And, you know, I also feel that the healthcare industry, if it goes to the universal healthcare, I think it's going to go the way of the welfare system. You know, that was meant to be for emergencies, to help people in need, and we've got people who are lifers who have been on it, their children are on it, their children have children who are on it, and I just think that this poor country, I just don't know where this country is going, and it really concerns me. And I feel the same way as the lady who in Elk Grove who said about the drug industries. I really feel that they are controlling the health care. I think we need to not look at the actual health insurance. I think we need to look at the drug industries.
Well, let me say a couple things. One is in terms of ads on TV. It's kind of interesting that you mentioned that because there are limits on certain ads. The alcohol industry for many, many years has operated under a different circumstance than most other industries. You didn't see that many ads on television for prescription drugs in the past as you had over the last 10 to 15 years. One of the reasons for that is that you would find people more willing to say to their doctor than, say, 20 years ago, what about this drug, or I know a friend who used this, or tell me about that. That's both the good and the bad of it. I mean, I think people are more informed than they were before, and they're making judgments or seeking out answers from their doctors than they did before. At the same time, it puts a lot of pressure on the doctor to perhaps acquiesce in the use of a particular drug that the doctor may not be as confident or as that the doctor deems is absolutely necessary. So that's probably the downside of it. The reason why there's advertising on television is, in fact, because the pharmaceuticals have found that that is one way for them to attract information or attract attention to their particular product. There are restrictions now as to what the pharmaceutical salespeople can do in terms of presenting their drug and the advantages of the drug as they see it to doctors. They used to do that by way of dinners, in some cases a weekend getaway where there would be a number of doctors and their families, and they would discuss these things, and the pharmaceutical company would pay for it. That is basically frowned upon today, and so in some ways the pharmaceutical industry has done a direct advertising to the patient, who is the consumer. Now, you know, in some aspects, I've suggested that we need more information, greater transparency. People need to know more about the possibilities that are out there. And so you would say, well, they get that by way of advertising. Sometimes when you listen to all of the adverse effects or potential adverse effects or side effects, you wonder why anybody would take some of this stuff. But that is required by law, and that is part of the FDA's responsibility to enforce that sort of thing. That is, that you ought to be given information about what the benefits of a particular drug
don't even get a chance to express our concerns about these kind of programs. So it's great that you've got these kind of calls and town meetings going. With that said, you know, one thing that hasn't been mentioned tonight by any of the callers, at least from the time I got on, was what one of the major costs of health care is, and that's in the legal system. I don't want to imply in my comments here that I'm against the legal system, but they take a tremendous amount out of the system, both in the unnecessary testing that was mentioned earlier, the rotator cuff example, as well as in the settlement side, you know, for the doctors or the practitioners that make the mistakes. If we were to somehow revamp the tort system or whatever that deals with the malpractice, I think we would see a substantial reduction in the health care as well, and that might bring it into line to make it affordable for a lot more people.
Well, I think you make an interesting point. I actually did medical malpractice defense for about 5 years before I went to Congress the first time around. I represented hospitals and doctors. Also had a couple of plaintiff's cases. I had one of the first successful lawsuits against an HMO who had denied coverage, actually denied treatment in a number of circumstances to my client, their patient, and they were clearly in the wrong. And in fact, we went to it was an arbitration, but I had three retired California appellate judges who were on that, and they gave me an unanimous decision on behalf of my client. But most of my work was done on the defense side, and I would say that probably 85% of the cases that I saw really had no basis. About 10% were questionable, and about 5% they had real claims. And so the question is, how do you preserve the ability of someone to really pursue those 5% and at the same time do something about the 85 to 95% that have little or no justification? One of the suggestions that I came up with was to have a loser pay provision, meaning that the loser in a case like that would have to pay the court costs. Another proposal would be to have a recommendation at the time of settlement conference. Under California law, in the civil code there, you're required to complete all of your discovery, meaning you're supposed to know your case and be ready to go to trial by the time you go to settlement conference. It seems to me at that point in time, if you're a defendant, a defense attorney, you ought to be able to lay before the court a particular petition in which you say, look, we either have no liability whatsoever, or we have minimal liability, and we're willing to either offer nothing because we have no liability, or we're going to offer this small amount because we have limited liability, and you put that on the record. At that point in time, the judge can inform the plaintiff's counsel and plaintiff's attorney that if, in fact, at the end of the case, the defendant is let out or the defendant pays what has been offered here or less as a result of the decision made by the jury, the judge may very well entertain a motion at that time to have all the costs that were involved with the trial itself borne by the plaintiff. Now, those different approaches or a variation of those approaches may actually help to balance the inherent imbalance that exists now. What happens, and I had this happen many different times when I was in settlement conference, the judge trying to settle the case would turn to me, and I'm representing a hospital or a doctor that's a tangential defendant, and would say, look, throw in the cost of the suit. Meaning, you know, if you're going to have to sit through this trial for a period of time, the costs of your representation to your client and therefore the insurance company are going to be $10,000, let's say. Well, the judge would say, throw in $5,000 and it'll be cheaper for the insurance company. Well, you do that after time and time and time again, that really causes the rates to go up. If at the same time, the settlement judge could say to the plaintiff's attorney, look, you're obligated I just want to tell you